Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
And gentlemen,
let's get ready to be inspired! Introducing in the red corner, American Tennis! And introducing in the blue corner, your host for American Tennis, Mr. Chuck Griese! Ladies and gentlemen, time to get in the game.
Fans, good morning once again. This is Coach Chuck Griese, and this is American Tennis. Every Wednesday at noon Eastern Standard Time, you can listen to American Tennis on the UR Tennis Network. That's the letter U, the letter R, the number 10, and the number S, or the letter S, excuse me, Network. And we have shows all week long on the UR Tennis Network. I'd like to ask you to tune in on Mondays at noon for Lisa Stone's Parenting Aces show. And also, American College Tennis Experience with Jason Haynes. It comes on 2 o'clock Eastern Time every Wednesday. Before we do anything else, I would like to congratulate Jason Haynes, the start of the fourth year of the UR Tennis Network. I get to do the show that starts out the fourth year, and I could not be more proud to do so. I just want to give as much credit and as much tribute to Jason Haynes as I can for started the UR Tennis Network. He started primarily, and I want to get this right, so I want to credit, say this in the best way, but Jason felt that there are hundreds and hundreds of tennis people out there that just don't get credit for what they're doing, primarily college coaches who sweat in day in, day out, then all of your teaching pros, and just so many good people giving their time, and for whatever reason, we are not covered enough on the radio, on the television, in the newspapers. Tennis in Europe and many places in the world is the number two sport, and it makes sense because it is not that expensive to play, and it has international visibility. But for some reason in the United States, we're 21 or 22 or something like that. And Jason felt like the more visibility we could have, the better. And over the last 3 years, oh, golly, we've had hundreds of shows and many, many wonderful hosts and many, many guests on the show and many, many different points of view and many, many different opinions. I think that this medium itself is now spreading. There are other tennis radio shows throughout the week, and I've seen the difference that it has made in just people's ability to be able to talk about things, and also their willingness to step up and say some things that are not that popular or maybe not are the middle of the road. They're able to operate a little bit on the fringes. And this is very, very good for our sport. It's you know, we're not in the box anymore, and we are talking about these issues, and we have other people talk about the issues. I think the We Coach Tennis website with J.P. Weber and the We Coach Tennis program is a very, very good one also. And with American Tennis every Wednesday, I always remind you that your duty is to stand up and to speak out. Don't just let things come and go. And I want to tell you a quick story, and this is maybe bugs you about tennis as much as it does me. This has been some 15 years ago. We were at the ACC tournament. I was coaching at Clemson back then, and everybody's pretty nervous before we started the event. It's morning of the first matches, and the tournament director, Jim Russell, by the way, Jim passed away 2 years ago, and what a wonderful, wonderful man and referee he was. But Jim would talk about anything, and he was a best friend to everybody, and he just was a great guy to have as a referee. He would talk through things, and we were standing there talking, and two or three coaches came up and said a few things to me and had a gripe about this or that, just nervous the way coaches are before they compete. And Jim says, boy, what are they all nervous about? They're talking about this guy or this thing or that thing. And I said, Jim, you know what's wrong with tennis? We all, especially when we're nervous, we all sort of try to put another person's light out, trying to think that maybe it makes ours shine a little brighter if we do this. And you don't climb to the top of the ladder by stepping on other people to get there. We all know that. But in tennis, there's just something about it that it is a combative, and we don't have a we don't lift others up as readily as we should. And I said, Jim, already four people have come up to me sort of talking about other people. I said, Jim, let's talk again this afternoon, but keep track of how many people talk about somebody else. And so about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and this is about 6 or 7 hours later, I come up to him, and I said, Jim, what's going on? How many people have come up to you and said something about somebody else? He said, 53 so far, Coach. I said, you've got to be kidding. I said, there you go. There you go. And, you know, it is something about tennis, it being a combative, that we a lot of times will try to make our own light shine brighter by trying to put somebody else's out. And I'm not saying everybody. And you do get to a different stages in life to where you start to recognize those people and those great people of wisdom that you should, and maybe you outgrow some of that, but I think we got too much of that. I watched the Masters this last week, as most of you did, and what a classy, honorable sport golf is. And, you know, everybody's playing against the course, and everybody wants to win. And as Bubba Watson and that new yet young guy, 20-year-old guy, Cam, what was his name, Sheath or Steve or something, but they were walking up the last hole there, and I was thinking about it, how, you know, the respect that you have for the game first and the honor, the way that you honor the game and then respect each other. I think that's probably the thing that is most touching about that. And as I've gotten later in my coaching career, I absolutely do tell players that tennis will not serve you if you try to make it give you something, if you try to dig something out of it. It will not. The tennis gods just don't work that way. I said, first you must honor the sport, and then the sport will honor you. If you don't, it will cut you to bits. So you honor the game. You respect your opponent. Even if you don't like the person, you respect them as a fellow warrior, as a fellow gladiator, as a fellow boxer, a wrestler, somebody that you have to do combat with. And then you respect them, and what happens is that it puts you in a position where you honor the sport and you're, you know, just very proud to be a competitor in that sport. So I just think that with speaking out and saying those things and getting the things on the table that we need to say is critically important to our game, and I think it helps us to move forward. We've been critical of many, many things over this past couple years with the American Tennis Program, and Jason's show and Lisa's show brings out a lot of different viewpoints and issues. This is all healthy. This is the American way. Let's get things on the table. I always say that Edmund Burke, as his statement says, all that it takes for evil to prosper is for good people to do nothing. And we don't believe that everything is evil, but we do believe that if you hold things in, it doesn't suit anybody. It does not do anyone any good, and it does not suit our sport well. I love the blogs that are out there now, Lisa Stone's. I love the We Coach Tennis that has over 1,000 participants in that Facebook website, the We Coach Tennis. I'd like to credit J.P. Weber for what he has done there. So, but hats off to Jason Haynes and what he has done with the UR Tennis Network. This is the start of the fourth year. Been completing three years and hundreds of shows. So, Jason, this goes out to you out there, and thanks very, very much. Folks, we've got an interesting show today. We have a guest coming on in a few minutes, Mr. Brad Emmendorfer, and I ask him back because he has so many interesting insights about why he has his kids playing a lot of different sports and not just tennis. Brad is former number one in the United States in junior tennis, and there's few people that are finer human beings, but great, great competitor, and he said that he'd come by here a little bit later and be able to speak to y'all. I wanted to say that this is the UR Tennis Network. Every week, if you want to call and be a guest on the show, you can call or just listen to the show at area code 714-583-6853. Look at my blog and my website and the former shows at chuckcreasy.net. That's K-R-I-E-S-E.net. T3Mentorship.com. T3Mentorship.com is a place where Alex Slezak has helped me to get some of my videos, some of my audios, and some of the things put up there. But you can get it all at chuckcreasy.net. We will be running my 38th summer of total tennis training camps in five different locations this summer. Look at the T3 mentorship, That's TotalTennisTraining.com for my camp, so you can get it at ChuckCreasy.net as well. Folks, today we're going to talk a little bit about the 8 action steps that I wanted to bring to your attention and continue to bring to attention in the coming weeks. You've heard me talk about many of them before, but I wanted to talk to them about these are action steps after being on some committees and after the years I've done in college tennis and working with juniors and then being around the world and traveling for those 2 years when I went to Thailand and things. But these are 8 action steps I really think would make a huge, huge difference if we sort of just took notice of them. I think we're barking up some of the wrong trees. These action steps are things that I think that if you would take a few minutes and just think through them, we could really make a difference if we could get some of these changed. But we've got to go to a commercial. We will be right back with American Tennis, and I'm Coach Chuck Creasy. Be back in a second. And this is Coach Chuck Creasy, and I wanted to tell you about our 2014 Total Tennis Training Camps at 5 different sites this summer. We will be in Charleston, Lexington, South Carolina, Landrum, South Carolina, Sumter, South Carolina, and the Atlanta area. Go to ChuckCreasy.net, and you can click on Total Tennis Training Camps, or you can go to TotalTennisTraining.com, see what weeks are available, and learn more about our camps. Tennis is much more than forehands and backhands. We teach the physical, the mental, and the emotional aspects of the game. The power of momentum is something that I have worked on since 1979. Over these near 40 years, I have been trying to come up with simple rules that will help a tennis player or any competitor learn about the power of momentum. I now have 8 simple steps that your child can learn if they come to my camps this summer. The power of momentum, physical, mental, emotional parts of the game, all of these you will learn at Total Tennis Training Camps this summer. Again, go to ChuckCreasy.net, and we'll see you this summer. This is Coach Chuck Creasy in American Tennis. And as I mentioned, I wanted to talk about the 8 action steps that I really believe would help us as we try to, I don't want to say right the ship. We've been doing a pretty darn good job, but you've got to admit that we have not turned out as many top players in the past 10 years as we have in the previous years. I always give the statistic that in 1985 we had 39 players, actually it was 84, 39 players that had gone to USA colleges and made the top 100. That's American-born players. Today we have at latest 3. Actually, the Kwan guy that played at gosh, yeah, Bradley Kwan, I guess it is. He just played at Stanford. We have Steven Johnson, who's just broken in as well, and we have John Isner. Now, I wanted to say that tomorrow is National Signing Day, by the way. Actually, it's today, the 16th is National Signing Day. And millions and millions of dollars will go out to tennis players and in the form of athletic scholarships. Millions and millions and millions of dollars have gone out. And we, unfortunately, probably about 60% of this is going to international players right now. And I speak about this often on my radio programs, and believe me, folks, I have nothing against the international player at all. I was able to do my training in the great Harry Hoffman, and I think of Dennis Vandermeer, and people like this who have contributed so much to our American tennis. What I am against is the players going out and playing professional tennis in other countries, and they coming to our college system because they're basically failed professionals, and use up some of the scholarship money. As a matter of fact, most of the scholarship money on both the men and the women's side that should be going to your son, your daughter, my son, my daughter. And somebody says, well, they're really great kids. Well, you know what? My son, my daughter, great kids too. And I just think that the money should be going there. The thing that has bothered me for many, many years is that Title IX was not set up to protect women from Spain or Portugal or Russia or China or Thailand or Indonesia or any of these countries. Title IX was set up to protect your daughters, my daughters, and give them an opportunity to go to college, but it's not so. But I just wanted to mention that it cut off on that tangent, but in 1984 we had 39 players that were USA-born and went to college, and it was the natural stepping stone to become a great player and to try the Pro Tour, to go on the Pro Tour, because we had 39 players who were in the top 100. Today we have three. John Isner, of course, has been in the top 100 for a while, but Bradley Kwan there, and then, of course, Steven Johnson have broken in. But three is a far sight from the 39 that we've had in the 80s. And people say, well, it's an international sport. Everybody else is catching on. Well, that doesn't fly for me as someone who believes in the USA and what we should be doing. On the women's side, it's been 20 years, folks, since Lisa Raymond was a player at, I think, University of Florida, and then she went out and made top 100. And I think Gretchen Rush was another. I think we've only had one other girl, the Falcone girl, that went to Georgia Tech. So it is sore subject with me. But we're going to talk about eight action steps. My guest today, Brad Emmendorfer, is here with me, and I've gotten a chance to talk to Brad for a long time about many of these issues. Brad went to college actually on a tennis scholarship. I was lucky enough to coach him at Clemson University, and he went through every phase of the program and the training. He ended up as team captain. He actually made it to number one singles and number one doubles. And at one time, Brad, you were the number one player in the United States. I can remember going. Well, you said you were two. You were two, and I remember going to the national indoors right after I had been married, or I took my wife there and watched you play. And there was James Blake, and there was Jeff Morrison, Josh Goffey, Darren Knight, you. But you were the number one seed there, so I was watching you, and you were in a big Tennessee hat, and I said, no way recruiting that guy, but I did recruit you, and you did come to Clemson. And talk about just a little bit about how hard it was for you growing up in Athens, Tennessee, to become a great tennis player.
Well, thanks for having me on, Coach. You know, I think growing up in a small town, Athens, Tennessee, this town of 15,000 people and, you know, really in the heart of East Tennessee. And I don't know, looking back, it probably the benefit may have outweighed, you know, the challenges. I was very fortunate to have a great junior coach, Ralph Cameron, who was extremely knowledgeable and really did a great job building my core.
He was in Knoxville, correct?
In Knoxville, right. But he had lived in Athens. And that's how we met.
You had to drive.
We drove 50 miles. You know, I now, of course, also coming out of Athens, came from a background where work was the only way to get things done. So there was, honestly, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week on the tennis court at 11 or 12 years old from my father's and Rob both had the same mentality and you know, it instilled it in me. But, you know, the good thing about where I grew up is, I think I was telling you earlier, nobody treated me, you know, the more success that I saw, it was rewarding because of the things I'd worked to get. But nobody treated me like I was special because nobody really – gave a darn about tennis there.
Yeah, you were small town tennis, USA, and it's football, basketball.
Right, it's football, basketball, baseball.
So they thought, what's this guy playing tennis? You might as well be playing the tuba or clarinet in the band.
Sure.
Or you might as well be, you know, doing art classes or drama or something. And in Athens, Tennessee, you probably had to hide your racket a little bit.
Yeah, well, you know, I wrestled and played tennis up until sixth grade, and that wrestling, they used to, you know, basically tell us not to act like a bunch of tennis players. And the truth is, you know, you learn the physicality of tennis. I mean, it's an unbelievably tough sport and mentally and physically. But the great thing is that I learned, I got fortunate to have a coach in Knoxville. My parents committed the time to get me there. But in Athens was given, you know, nobody cared, so therefore I took a sense of, I guess I got my reward from my hard work, and then I also never was treated like I was somebody special, so I never acted like I was better than, you know, the team mentality.
Your ego,
upper college tennis
your, yeah, your ego got kept in check.
Right.
And that's a good thing. But tennis, the special sport of tennis, was something you could do that was unique. It was yours. And if you were like me, I felt that I had something that nobody else had. I had this skill set growing up that most of the other kids had. And it was a skill set that you were.
Yeah.
And that you were in love with. And then you fall in love with the competition.
With the competition.
And everything, the training, and then you go from there. But, Brad, we had a whole show with you about 2 or 3 months back, and the thing is, what I would like for you to relay is our first point here that I want to talk about 8 action steps today that I really think we need to do. I don't say to save American tennis, but daggone it would make a heck of a difference. College tennis, folks, as I've been talking about, is the necessary stepping stone for our youngsters to go to higher levels. This is where you get the skill set. Our youngsters are not as mature at 16, 17, 18 years old as players from other countries who have traveled the world already. They've done a lot of different things. They've been maybe a little bit more spoiled. Maybe they are. They are. They haven't traveled as much. Most of the time their mom and dad set everything up for them. And the point is that college is needed. We need college for our players. I mean, it's so critical. But the first point I want to make is, folks, let's start talking about a 2-player limit for every college. Now, they've done this in junior college, and nobody's challenged it. There are no lawsuits. 3 weeks ago, Lisa Stone's show had the executive director of the ITA. And David has always said that they consulted with lawyers, and we were opening ourselves up for lawsuits if we tried to put a 2-player scholarship limit on foreign players. And I keep asking myself, Brad, does that make sense? Now, who's going to sue? Do you think the kids will sue? No, because every country in the world every country in the world has a two-player limit on foreign players. If you play soccer in Brazil, a two-player limit.
Yeah.
If you play Bundesliga in Germany, it's a two-player limit. So the players aren't going to sue. Are the parents going to sue? No, they're not. They're not going to sue the foreign parents. Are the coaches themselves going to sue? Could you imagine a coach suing and saying, look, I want to have more foreign players on the
right.
team? You'd be ostracized.
I guess, that's really, Coach, I guess maybe the first time I'd heard that, but it reminds me specifically of my father was cut from the Canadian Football League because they could only have so many Americans.
Right.
And he went back to dental school. And there wasn't a problem with that, but in today's time, what is the difference in that and the fact that in the NBA now you have to go to college for 1 year before you go pro? So could somebody not turn around and sue for that rule? I mean, it's implementing a rule. You're implementing a rule. Of course you could. I mean, pretty soon it seems as if you'd have to do away with all rules. A rule is unfair to somebody.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, we have too many rules in a lot of things. And this is one that should be in there. I mean, it would be very simple to implement. Just two scholarships. You can do anything you want, two foreigners per team. And, Brad, we have a precedent. To everybody out there, check the junior colleges right now. We have a precedent. Junior college only allow two international players.
Okay.
And that'd be fine.
Right. Well, I mean, I think what's also critical in this is I just brought up basketball, and I've been on this since last time I spoke to you, I think. But what other sport in America does not use college as a stepping stone to the highest level? I mean, you've got to go. Now, the basketball, they implemented this rule because of the fact that kids were leaving too soon. They weren't ready. So now they have to go to college to get ready. Football, they definitely got to go to college to get ready. Baseball, you can get drafted at high school. Most Americans, baseball, you got two options, basically. But a good amount of college, they have a Major League Baseball college draft, I think. There's not another sport where college is detrimental to reaching the highest level. When you look at taking two of those spots away on a four scholarship, so you've got a complex problem here.
Well, I am wondering where the lawsuits would come from. I don't see it. And if they did, could you imagine so-and-so is suing because we don't have enough international players? And nobody is against international players.
Right.
But all of us should be against all of the spots being taken by international players.
I would say if you don't want to regulate the amount of international players, then you should add scholarships to the sport.
What would happen there? So,
well, then this my mate too, I guess.
Well, here's the thing, folks. Okay, and I've recruited for years, and pretty much the top 50 or 60 players in the country, if your son or your daughter, top 50 or 60 in the country, they're going to get snatched up by a top school, and they're going to get recruited by a top school. However, if your son or your daughter is 60 on down, they're going to be competing against 80 or 90 other countries of the world, their top 10 players.
Mm-hmm.
So there are 700 or 800 more players that they're competing against, and therefore they get left out. And this is the tragedy. As women get 8 full scholarships, about 65% of those scholarships go to foreign players. And my daughter, your daughter, is getting left out on the tennis scene. And the tennis is not a training ground for the professionals anymore. A lot of people will say, well, so few do it. But, look, I don't buy into that argument that nobody's going to make it anyway. The reason nobody is making it is that we have so few Americans in there. And then also, Brad, the training that goes on in college ranks.
Yeah, I just don't understand. I was actually talking to a couple guys on your team, Coach, about your teams in the 80s, but I was talking about how successful some of those teams were, and you talk about Jay Berger, who played number four.
Five and then four.
And being able to compete in the U.S. Open, and where, I mean, that wasn't, I mean, the prime of American tennis, where we really dominated the sport from those days to where you had Currier and Agassi. I mean, it wasn't that far removed from right now. It was 20 years ago. We were still dominating, right?
Yeah.
So the question is, what has changed and why has it changed? You know, it's
I'll give you a better one. John McEnroe, think about this. He qualified at Wimbledon in spring of 77, I guess it was, and I had to come through the qualifier, won all the way to the semifinals of the main draw men's Wimbledon.
Yeah.
He came back and went to Stanford, and he lost four matches. He lost to Larry Gottfried twice. I think he lost to Hank Pfister and Eddie Edwards, if I'm not mistaken. And so he lost four matches, and then he won the NCAA in a very historical match to John Sadri, 7-6, 7-6, 5-7, 7-6. Sadri never lost serve, but he lost in four sets to McEnroe. And what great, here's his semifinals of Wimbledon, comes back to play college. Jay, I told the story earlier, also about Jay. Interesting, he didn't want to play junior tennis. He was only 16 when he came, or his first year 18. I made him go back and play all the junior events. He won the clay courts, won Kalamazoo, got straight in to the U.S. Open. Wildcard, he won three matches, lost in four sets to Yannick Noah. He came back for like a three-quarter scholarship or something, came back and played all year. And think about that. You turn down probably $20,000 to come back and play. But the training was that good in the college ranks. And now we're having to piecemeal it since 1992 with limited dates of competition, limited practice hours, limited this, limited that.
Shorten.
And now we're playing these Bullwinkle scoring systems. And wait a minute, we're stopping the matches when somebody gets to four because fans might leave. And what we've done is diluted, polluted, prostituted maybe the greatest training ground in the world for players. And it's just awful. It's not the training ground that it should be. Brad, your point, I want to take that a little further, though. Football, basketball, baseball, we have 6,000 people making a living in professional baseball somewhere. We only have 14 tennis players. So, folks, the number one thing is college, we need a limit on two players. Any other quick thoughts there, Brad, and we're going to move on to the next one?
You know, I think for college tennis, for American tennis to continue to succeed, it's going to be changing gears on how we recruit players, and we got to start recruiting talent, not early results.
Well, athletes.
You got to
get our athletes.
Recruit potential
from our, and then coach them up. You got to coach them up. You don't just recruit international players and put them out there and say rah rah. Well, what's your name? We can't really pronounce your name.
Sure.
You're going to be here 4 years and then you're gone. And look, to be fair, there's a lot of great young men. Andrew Brown came over to the University of Miami, and he spent the rest of his life over here training young kids, and he's worked in Atlanta and done a lot of great things, and he's contributed on and on and on. And you have a lot of great international friends that have stayed here.
Sure, from the sport of tennis, you know, that's great. It's just the fact that we are suffering in our sport because of lack of interest and lack of opportunity.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's two ways to get into the U.S. Open with a wild card, and one of them is the NCAA tournament. And half of the field is not from
America. It's foreign, and I don't know if that's still the same. Might change it. U.S. Open, or excuse me, Kalamazoo still sends a junior player there. But anyhow, that's one thing. Oh, gosh, the switchboard's lighting up here. But hold on, folks, because, you know, we really got to get through these eight action steps here, and I'll try to get to you. All right, here's what I've got, action step number two, Brad. We need to really define what participation-centered objectives are and performance-centered objectives. There's a big, big difference. I think that the USTA has, they have one organization there, and they have sort of the social part of it or the community part of it or the participation part of it. Now, that might include your 10 and under tennis, might even include 12 and under tennis, but very quickly, somewhere around puberty, I believe that you need to get kids competing where it needs to be more about performance and not about participation. And I think about Michael Jordan. If he was, wonder if he would have been as great a basketball player had he not been cut from the team. And I'm wondering, when we give participation trophies to so many kids, how many kids are out there hitting on the backboard until their hands get blisters because they want that trophy? If they already get a participation trophy, what's the difference? You know, are they going to spend that extra time? We're just missing the boat. But to be fair, yeah, you know, I want my daughter, who's not too serious about tennis yet, maybe participation stuff is good. But at the same time, I'm learning my son in Little League Baseball, last year he enjoyed participating. This year he wants to win.
Sure.
He's tired of losing. He does not want to just participate.
I think that the way that our society's transitioned is kids have so many options and they're given so many things that we've had to give them a treat just to participate. So now people are giving a trophy just that you'll, you know, just for going out there, where participation should be to find out if that's the avenue that you want to compete in or if you like the sport. And then after you decide that you like to participate, then you compete and you go to the competition phase to earn the trophy. You know, what's happened is you've got an iPad and a Wii and you're offering trophies just to get them outside to participate, you know, and all of a sudden we've got a real problem here because the guy who actually earns something gets the same reward as the guy who...
We've dumbed down success. We've dumbed
sure.
down success. Last week I used the example of when you give participation trophies. Somebody, we were talking about having to have fun and competing, and actually I was on J.P. Weber's show with Bill Wright. We're talking about fun with competing. And I said, you know, the first time you go to amusement park, or Walt Disney World, first day, your kids are thrilled. Second day, they're going, oh, okay, I rode that yesterday. This is still fun. The third day, they're saying, can we go do something else? Mm-hmm. So the point is the trophies become the same way, too. We dumb down achievement, and we dumb down the expectation for kids have to desire it deeply. I mean, I will know if my son's a real ball player in baseball when he's out there and throwing the ball up against the garage,
yep.
and he's fielding grounders on his own over and over and over.
That's exactly right. You know, it's that's the reason why my children right now are I'm letting them play any sports that they can or that they ask to play, because the truth of the matter is, to reach your ultimate potential, you have to be doing it on your own, and it has to be self-driven. And again, you know, that's one of the things that's made this country great, and creating opportunity for those that are self-driven. And tennis is an avenue that is maybe a little narrower than it once was. You know,
my daughter's playing piano, and the other day walked over to her shoot practice. She said, I hate practicing piano. And I said, but honey, you're getting so much better. But she says, I hate practicing piano. And most kids will say, I hate practicing piano because it's so repetitive.
Yeah.
They can't express yet. So I went on YouTube and I got her a sort of a quick video of Immortal Beloved and Beethoven where he – is puts his head down on the piano and he's playing Moonlight Sonata, and it's so passionate. And so, and I said, honey, this is the way you have to feel the music. She said, but Papa, I hate playing the piano. You know, and the point is with the tennis, like we say, and I know when my son loves baseball enough or tennis enough, when they start smacking the ball against the wall and you're having to say, shut up, quit, get out of there. What are you doing? It's too much noise. Quit making so much noise. You know?
Well, the thing about, let's think about this, because your child, and teaching your kid what loving something means, I love tennis doesn't mean I'm going to always smile and laugh at the things I have to do to be great at it. I love my wife, and there's struggles in that relationship. Well, if you love a sport,
it's not always fun.
It's not easy.
It's not always fun being married.
But it works. You know,
yeah,
you know, it's just the thing about the sport. You've got to sacrifice an ultimate prize.
Yeah, you're exactly right with your wife. Always say you love your wife on your very, very worst day.
That's right.
And her worst day, you love her anyway.
Well, and the same thing goes for, you know, in a different way, your sport. Yeah,
hitting, love it anyway.
My coach would give me a list. It would be 2,000 balls against the wall at Heritage Park, and then I'd have to hit 200 serves. Well, that's pretty boring when you think about you're the only one there. You're playing with a ball in a concrete wall, but you love it. Therefore, you go through those tests.
You go through it, and you go through the pain of losing,
right,
and all those things. So we're barking up the wrong tree, folks, about the participation versus performance. And please understand that if your youngster's at puberty and they're not into performance-driven things, and that means no back draws, double back draws. That means full matches, 2 out of 3 set matches. Don't do these. Well, that's another one of the action steps. But, all right, bring back the satellites and more pro tournaments. We only have like 32 futures out there, but here's what I liked about the satellites in the old days, Brad. The satellites, you would go the first day to, and satellites, folks, were, instead of the futures, you would go to these tournaments where there's 4 weeks in a row. You had to go 4 weeks in a row if you wanted to get your ATP points. So the first week, you'd have 300 people there. The second week, you'd be down to 130. Third week, there'd be 50. And then at the Masters, you'd have 16. And you go, whoa, what happened to all the people? Now, a couple things happened. First of all, when you lost, only the real tennis players survived, only the people that loved it. The rest sort of took Dad's Diner Club card, and they went back home and said, look, I'm out of it. It's too hard. And the other thing is, if you made it through the satellites, you were king of the satellites. You really snowball or springboarded up into much higher levels. Now the point structure, I think, was much better, and players could really win 3 or 4 satellites and then have good enough rankings to get in some qualifying for tour events. Now the point structure is such that there is no future in the futures. So it's terrible, the point structures. What else?
It's almost like, you know, the value of the dollar. It's dumbed down a little bit. You know, if you give it away too easy, it's,
Well, the futures, listen, folks, the futures, as you know, there's no future in the futures. What we've done is we've made it easy. Player with Dad's Diner Club can go down and play. I'm playing pro tennis.
It's vacation.
It's vacation. By the way, where are you staying at? Well, I'm staying at a Marriott, and rough match today. I lost 4 in the 3rd, and we are eating at Outback tonight and with my buddies. And how much did you spend this week? A couple grand to lose in the qualifying or something. And so what happens, the future sort of keep false hopes. And as we said, it keeps the pretenders alive. Pretenders, contenders, it keeps the pretenders alive. The satellites did not keep them alive. So that's number 3. Is we got a few minutes here, but you had a quick thought.
That's right.
Okay, number 4, this is the biggest one, folks. And number 4 is the huge one about we really do need to get rid of the point system for evaluating matches in the junior ranks. Right now, we have top-down management where the USTA delegates points to certain tournaments. In other words, Brad, in Athens, Tennessee, it doesn't matter whether you spent 50 years to build up a great event there and it was bringing in all of the top players in the South and from around the country. I, from in a higher management bureaucracy position, bureaucratic position, delegate you to an L3. You're no longer a top
level.
Right.
You're
not a top level because you don't have the right courts and you don't have enough